The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you may be familiar with my next guest. Even if you're not listening to the show on a regular basis, you'll probably know who David Meerman Scott is. David's the first book he wrote that got my attention was The New Rules of Marketing and PR. It came out late 06 or early 07, and it really blew me away. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Always great to chat with you.
And with you. We missed a book, and I apologize for that. you co-wrote a book that came out last year.
Actually, this year, and that's why, because, you know, they're doing so many books, we can't keep up.
Well, and you know, other authors would call and complain. Well, David's been on twice, and you haven't called me. So, tell me, you know, there was some very cool stuff in Marketing the Moon, but why'd you write the book?
Marketing the Moon, because it's the greatest marketing and public relations and sales case study ever, as far as I'm concerned. The idea that we, meaning the American government, convinced the American taxpayers to spend 2% of our national budget and devote 4% of our workforce to send 12 people to the surface of the moon for the Apollo program. I mean, to me, it's just absolutely incredible. And nobody had ever looked at the marketing and public relations and sales side of the Apollo Moon program before. There's probably 1,000 books written about space travel and the Apollo program, but no one had examined what went on to get us to the moon from the perspective of marketing.
That's true, and the story was remarkable because it wasn't just, you know, the NASA PR machine. It was all of the contractor players involved as well that were just doing this remarkable job selling the concept. But, you know, I guess the cool thing is that it came to fruition.
Oh, yeah. And you know what, Mark? I mean, you live this stuff. I mean, this was a government program that we got right. I mean, incredibly, it worked in every way that people wanted it to work. And one of the things that we explored, I wrote the book with a co-author. His name is Rich Jurek. We are both marketing and public relations and sales professionals. And then Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon, wrote the foreword to the book. But what Rich and I explored, which had never really been talked about before, was from the perspective of communicating around Apollo, the contractors, companies like IBM and Boeing and Raytheon, as well as some of the consumer products contractors that built things for the spacecraft and the astronauts, like Omega watches, for example, Hasselblad cameras, they all worked in partnership with NASA to get the word out to the media and directly to citizens about the Apollo program. And to me and to us, that was just a really, really interesting angle on the Apollo program, because everyone else we spoke with thought that NASA had this big, massive public relations and marketing machine to talk about Apollo. And while they did have, you know, a modest, by today's standards, public relations department, it was tiny compared to what they had to accomplish to feed 3,000 different media outlets and provide people to schools and other places that wanted to learn about Apollo. So it was that partnership with industry, that partnership with the contractors, that really was an amazing aspect of the Apollo Lunar Program.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable book. It's kind of a coffee table size book, but it's got, you know, it's a great story. It's got some wonderful pictures in it. And as usual, it's just extremely well written.
So. Thank you. Now it's just there's so many cool aspects. Another aspect that we explored and really explored for the first time was the Apollo program was one of our first forays into real-time communications. And that almost didn't happen. Live color television from the surface of the moon is a radical concept, and the technology required to do it was almost as difficult as getting humans to the surface of the moon itself. You know, before Apollo, in the early 1960s, a television camera weighed about 250 pounds. It was on these massive, rolling tripod kind of things, and they had to be hardwired, tethered into a studio. And even pictures from the Vietnam War, you see these wonderful color images from the Vietnam War. Those were typically shot on 16-millimeter film and then sent by airplane back to the studio in Washington to be shown on television. Apollo said, you know what, we're going to put live television on the surface of the moon and even put them on a lunar rover that's far away from the lunar module. And they did it. They pulled it off, and it took tens of millions of dollars to do it. But even more difficult than the technology almost was the fact that most of the astronauts and almost all of the technology people did not want it to happen. They didn't want it to happen because the astronauts said, we don't want to be we don't want to be actors on a television show. We don't want to be producers of a television show. We're astronauts. We have a job to do. We have to fly the mission. And there was one astronaut in particular by the name of Tom Stafford. He ended up flying as commander of Apollo 10, who said, no, we owe it to the American people. We've got to do this. And then he got together with a guy called Paul Haney, who's was the head of one aspect of the Public Relations Department of NASA at the time. And they basically argued, we must do this. Not only the astronauts said no, the technology people said no, because they said, it's going to cost too much in terms of weight to have a camera in the spacecraft. But they were able to get that originally 250-pound camera down to about 10 pounds. And they were able to do that through, at the time, with our iPhones, it seems kind of crude, but they were able to miniaturize the camera and then be able to have the technology to show astronauts on the surface of the moon. And that's the legacy of real-time communications for Apollo, something that, that we talk about today, real-time communications.
You talk about it a lot, and, there's a variety of cool things there, but imagine the conspiracy theorists who say it was still done in the studio had there not been the film.
Well, yeah, so. Exactly. Exactly right.
Oh, yeah, sure.
If you didn't have the film, if we didn't have that record, and it was just this voices, disembodied voices coming through a tape somewhere. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, somebody's in the basement talking on the poorly connected phone, right? So,
and by the way, the one thing that conspiracy theorists can't figure out is, well, if we really didn't go there, the Russians would have called us out on it, and the Russians never did call us out on it, so we made it.
Well, yeah, Russians, North Koreans, the wackos from Area 51, whoever. So, for those of you who haven't seen it, get this book. If you like anything about the moon programs, this book is absolutely part of your library. So,
and the other aspect, is all of this aspect of contractors working directly with a government agency and doing it right and truly working as partners. And having the American people be behind it. I mean, in today's partisan political environment, it seems almost unreal what they were able to accomplish.
That's true. But and here's the cool thing too, a lot of the contractors that you're talking about in that book are still with us today.
Absolutely,
still,
they are
still
yeah.
hand in glove working
Absolutely.
With the government. So long term relationships do pay some dividends here. So actually, we did marketing to the moon for the first segment. When we come back, we're going to talk about David's new book. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower because nobody else volunteered. My guest is David Mirman Scott. David is a multiple time guest here, friend, author of some of the best books on social media marketing, period. New Rules of Marketing and PR last summer came out, fourth edition. And the book we're here to talk about today, The New Rules of Sales and Service, How to Use Agile Selling, Real-Time Customer Engagement, Big Data Content and Storytelling to Grow Your Business. Why this book, David?
Why this book, Mark, is because there's a disconnect today between the ways that buyers are making buying decisions and the ways that sellers are selling. And it's basically, people are typically selling using a holdover to the days of before the web, when the salesperson controlled the relationship. Yet, in today's environment of the web, buyers have near-perfect information by going on the web, and they can learn all about a company's product offerings, all about its competitors, all about what people are saying about that company and its products. And the salesperson, therefore, is no longer in charge. So I just saw this big disconnect and wanted to try to explore that disconnect and provide some advice to organizations and the people within them for how they can sell and service their clients more effectively.
And, you know, there's a very mercenary reason for me having you on as often as I do, because I've actually been coaching companies on not necessarily the total social selling aspect of it, which is covered very thoroughly in this book, and we'll get into that. But just on, you know, leveraging a tool like LinkedIn in particular. So,
yes. And you helped me out with LinkedIn, Mark, and I thank you for that.
It's a pleasure to work with you on that, because you're one of my classic examples of different people have different needs on LinkedIn and have different messages to share. Yours is radically different, and it's always fun to work with you on particularly on your profile and maybe soon the activities in some of the groups. So,
thank you.
You bet. But let's talk about the new rules. You've got some very definite thoughts on the rules of social selling. So let's go there. Rule one being authentic storytelling.
Yeah. So I broke it down into five areas that that people need to be thinking about, and a lot of companies simply aren't. Well, I'll just rattle through each of them first. Authentic storytelling sets the tone for how an organization deals with its customers. And content becomes the link between companies and customers. And we've got big data, which is really important. We can talk about that, that enables a more scientific approach to sales and service. While agile selling, and this gets into that real-time aspect, agile selling brings new business to your company, and that real-time engagement keeps them happy. So authentic storytelling. Now, I chose that word storytelling purposely, because I really wanted it to feel like people have to come up with what it is that they're doing that's interesting. How do they organize themselves? What are some of the fundamental reasons why they're a company that's worthy of doing business with? And that comes back to a very basic human need, which is to tell stories to one another. And I think in the I'm going to get philosophical with you now, Mark, if that's okay. In the last 50 years or so, I think we've lost some of that storytelling. I mean, if you think like, and you and I weren't around then, but more than 50 years ago, you know, the ways our parents and grandparents did business was they typically knew the corner grocer, they knew the guy at the hardware store, they bought their you know, in the really early days of our great-grandparents, they bought their chickens from someone who told stories about chickens, and they had personal relationships with the companies that they do business with. But in the last 50 years or so, and basically for all our consuming lifetime, it's pretty much been mass marketing. It's been television advertising. It's been newspaper advertising and billboards and whatnot, and not so much around the idea of storytelling, at least not storytelling individually. It's more storytelling around a mass idea. But now the web brings us full circle back to the days of when someone was selling us a chicken, and we can actually communicate by telling stories again, by engaging people both as a group and smaller members in that group, but also even one-to-one. And that can happen through things like the web. It can happen through social networks like LinkedIn and Twitter. It can happen through a good old email even. And those things weren't happening and aren't happening in a lot of organizations. So bringing back the idea of storytelling, and I don't mean making up fairy tales, but more around, you know, what is this company doing? Why is this company important? You know, what are the reasons that this company is being valuable for its customers?
You know, one of my favorite all-time catalogs was the original Banana Republic catalog, and I don't know if I've shared this with you before.
No, you haven't.
It was an odd size. It was like a 5x7. It was sent out on parchment paper, and this is long before the stores occurred. But the company was started by a husband and wife team, and they went out and they found safari adventure-type clothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But throughout this parchment-like publication, it felt like papyrus or something, they would put in little vignettes about where they went and how they found stuff and why they thought it was cool.
Mm.
So it was stories.
Nice.
And you know, exactly what you're saying, but it was so different. It was just so much fun to read.
Right. Exactly.
So this is one of the reasons, you know, that your first edition of New Rules of Marketing PR, I read, as you know, back in 2007.
Yes.
And I had been on LinkedIn for 3 years at that time. And I, you know, you didn't talk about LinkedIn there, but you talked about how everybody was changing communications, how content was being shared in a totally democratized kind of way. And it just made me sit up and think, holy crap, this stuff is pretty darn cool.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it makes me think of a particular example. And, you know, of your area, Washington Sports Clubs. Washington Sports Clubs is owned by a company called Town Sports International. And they also own, I live in the Boston area, so that's how I'm familiar with them. They also own Boston Sports and New York Sports and Philadelphia Sports Clubs. And what's really cool about them is they have a personality, and that personality has really been branded through their ideas of stories. And what's interesting about the stories is that they actually took a look at how they're different from other health clubs. And what they noticed was that all the other health clubs were focused on having photographs of, you know, fit young bodies and look at this. If you go to our health club, you can lift weights too and you can have a fit, healthy body. And they said, you know, maybe we'll look at it a little bit differently. Maybe we'll be the humorous health club. Maybe we'll be the club that tells a more interesting story. And one of the things they do, which I absolutely love, is they focus on celebrities who are popular in the media at a particular time, and then they create these really cheeky advertisements around those celebrities, which I think is hysterical. So, for example, Chris Christie was in the news recently for his Bridgegate thing, and one of their ads said, "Don't worry, Chris, our members stop traffic too." When Miley Cyrus was in the news for twerking, their ad read, "Miley, better to work out than twerk out." When Charlie Sheen was in his issues around getting a contract signed or not signed for his television show, they wrote an ad, "Charlie, we can't offer $3 million per episode, but we can give you March for free." And my favorite one by far, Kim Jong-un, "With a great bod, you don't need a big missile." and so what's cool about these things is now what happens is people transfer the ideas of the story to themselves, and they tell themselves a story, and the story they tell themselves, if it's in sync with the story that the company is selling, that's where business happens. That's where the transaction happens. So when I think of myself, and I actually joined Boston Sports Club partly because of the way that they do these cool things, is do I want to join the serious health club where I have to go in and pump iron next to some brute? Or do I want to go to the guys who've got a sense of humor? Because I've got a kind of sense of humor, and I enjoy life, and I like to be funny. And, well, that's who I'm going to go to. I'm going to go to the ones who are a bit more fun. And, you know, that's how we all do business. We think of what story do we tell ourselves? I tell the story to myself that I want to have a really nice car, and I don't mind paying a little bit more money, so I'll go with an imported German model. And then if the way that company tells a story matches with me, then business can transact. So this idea of storytelling, again, it's not a made-up fairy tale, but it's what is it about your company that's interesting and unique and different? How can you describe that? And here's what's really important, is that needs to permeate from top to bottom in the organization, which means that it best is coming from the top, from the CEO, the person in charge of the company is the one who should be setting the tone with that story, almost like the conductor of an orchestra.
There you go. We're going to take our next break here. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm here with David Meerman Scott, whose new book is The New Rules of Sales and Service from Wiley. It is available everywhere. Back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is David Meerman Scott. David's got, is it 10 books out now, David?
10 books, Mark, 10 books.
There you go. And the latest, The New Rules of Sales and Service, is what we're discussing right now. So rule number two, is the content is a link between companies and customers. And I am a huge advocate of that.
Oh, absolutely, no question. And it's typically web-based content. It's things like your blog post, your blog posts, your company's website, your video channel, whether it's on YouTube or Vimeo or another channel. It's your social networking profiles. What are you putting out on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and whatnot? It's the infographics and other types of content that you're producing. And incidentally, when we're on the subject of content, I released a slideshare, Mark, and I think you may have seen it.
Oh, I went through it, yes.
Called The New Rules of Selling. I released it 10 days ago, and it's got 90,000 views already. I mean, what a sleeper form of content. I had never really thought of the slideshare platform, which is, of course, a LinkedIn property, slideshare being so important as a piece of content. But you know, what went through my mind is I want to reach salespeople with The New Rules of Sales and Service, my new book. What do salespeople like? Well, they typically like PowerPoint presentations because they deliver a lot of them. So why not deliver some content in the form of a presentation? And SlideShare is perfect, and pushed it out there. And I'm just flabbergasted that 10 days after I pushed it out, there's 90,000 views.
Well, you have a precedent here, because before New Rules came out, you had a PDF kind of ebook that was downloaded Lord knows how many times.
That one's over a million times. But, yeah, I always try to look at, and this is important for any company, but look at what is the type of content that your buyers are most likely to be looking at. And then how can you create a piece of content or a series of pieces of content within that particular type of online content? So, like you said, for the New Rules of Marketing and PR, I released an ebook. It's called The New Rules of PR. It's been downloaded way over a million times, and it helped to drive my international bestseller. And now with this newest book, and it's totally free, there's no registration, it's called The New Rules of Selling, to get this slideshare, and it's adding hundreds and hundreds of views every single hour. I mean, in the time that we're doing this interview, it will go up by 300 or 400 views. It's just an incredible thing to me. And that means, you know, what's the best content? Is it a great website? Is it a YouTube video? I mean, what is the best content to reach your buyers?
Well, here's the thought. you have one story in here that is germane to anybody who's a parent, but it's also germane to companies that are hiring and agencies that are hiring, and that's the story of your daughter's search for a college. And her search was a little different. So tell us that story, please.
Oh yeah, great. This is a great story. My daughter Allison is when she was a young teenager. She was about 14 or 15 years old. She started her college search on her own. We didn't have to prod her. She was probably in her freshman year of secondary school, and she just started to poke around on all these university websites on her own, you know, and we didn't have to push her into this at all, to the point that when she was a couple of years older, she was about 16 years old, and she was early in her junior year in high school, she came to us and said, "Mommy and Daddy, I want to go to Columbia University." And we were like, "What? Where did that come from, kid?" And she's like, "Yeah, I did all my research. I've went to hundreds of different college websites, and that's where I want to go because everything that they're talking about, it sounds like me. It's describing me. You know, they've got a research institution. It's based in New York City. But it also it's also a liberal arts school within a research university. And they have a core curriculum, which really resonates with me because I'll be able to learn the same classic texts that generations before me have learned from. And it just sounds like the perfect school for me. Now, what's fascinating about that is Allison did her own research. Allison is an active buyer. And we're the payers, by the way. We paid for a college education, but she was the one who was choosing. And then, after she made her choice, then was when all of these colleges started to market to her because she took the standardized tests. They got her names and addresses. And we got, she did pretty well on the standardized tests, so we ended up getting literally hundreds of packets of information through the mail and literally thousands of emails from colleges that wanted to get her attention. But she had already made her decision. She had made her decision based on the content on the Columbia University website. And fortunately, she got in to, you know, her first choice. She was really worried about not making it in, but she did get in. And now she's now starting her senior year at Columbia and enjoys it immensely, both New York City and the university. But that whole idea is emblematic of what's happening today. Is it's no longer a situation where salespeople pick up the phone and cold call you and try to sell you something. I mean, that still happens at a lot of companies. But more frequently what's happening is buyers are making their own independent decisions and the best content wins.
Well, you know, part of that content for Allison was students telling their own stories on the site.
Correct.
And,
yeah.
And part of your story was all of that direct mail that she never even looked at.
Never even opened it. It went into the recycle bin.
Yeah.
She told us that she, in reading the students' stories on the Columbia website, she was able to project herself there at the school and imagine herself there. And it goes back to what we talked about a little bit earlier with storytelling. The idea of the stories that Columbia was telling on its website in the form of these students explaining who they are and what they're about sort of started to dovetail with Allison's story she was telling herself about what she wanted for her college career. Mm-hmm. And that's when a buying decision happens. That's when she came to us and says, "Yes, this is where I want to go. This is where I want my dad's $250,000 of four-year tuition money to go to." So, you know, we're talking about $250,000 sale here. And so, you know, it's as expensive as B2B sales. It's a significant life event like it is to join a company. So I think those lessons resonate with a lot of different industries.
Well, they resonate with parents of high school juniors and seniors who see all of that mail coming in. There's another part to the content thing that I want to touch on real quick, though. You say that smart sellers not only deliver proprietary information, such as white papers, reports, etc., but they also curate information from other sources, from the web, from you know, pretty much anywhere. I call it leveraging other people's content. But,
yes.
But why is that important?
That's important because what you really want to do on the web, is particularly with social networking, is be helpful. and to educate people and to inform people rather than just try to sell to them. So by sharing other people's content, by focusing the attention away from yourself, sometimes, not always, but sometimes, you're showing that you're helpful and you're part of a community and you want to help your buyers to make their decisions. And that ultimately means that in those people's minds, you're very helpful. And ultimately, that means that people will trust you more because you're willing to point them in a direction that isn't always back to your own website or to your own videos or to your own blog posts. And some people have a hard time with that. And then if you take a look at their social numbers, they're not as strong. They don't have as many followers, as many friends as those people who are helpful and who are pointing people around the web.
Adds to the credibility in huge ways.
Absolutely, it does.
So big data.
Big data really is just the idea of gosh, we just have massive, massive amounts of data out there, massive computing power. And one of the things that's really interesting about if you focus on all this data and what it can tell you is that from a selling perspective, we can start to think about triggers and we can start to think about signals for when people might want to buy. And so, for example, I mean, you know, you certainly know LinkedIn better than almost everybody else out there. If somebody is you follow on LinkedIn, all of a sudden changes jobs. Maybe they change their job title at their current company, or they even change to a new company, or perhaps they go from a company to a government agency. That is a signal. It's a very important signal. Now, if they're in your buying process, if they're a target for your products or services, that signal becomes a trigger event that you should then reach out to them or in some way approach them, because now they are much, much, much more likely to pay attention to what you have to offer or maybe ready to buy something that you have to offer. The same thing is true, for example, if somebody you're targeting mentions your company or your brand. Oh, my gosh, they're thinking about us. That's a signal. That's a trigger event. Or, for example, if somebody is visiting your website and you find out that they're looking at certain pieces of your content, that's a signal. That's a trigger that they're maybe in the moving through the buying process. And big data is just this massive crunching of data that we can do to learn these things, to be able to sell in a more efficient way. And incidentally, not selling in the way that is best for us, but selling in the way that's best for the buyer when they're ready to make a buying decision.
Again, it adds to that credibility factor.
Absolutely, it does.
So.
And then there's, you know, this is just really, really, really powerful stuff.
Okay. We're going to take our last break here. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're discussing the new rules of sales and service with David Mearman Scott. Back after these. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is David Mearman Scott, author of The New Rules of Sales and Service, which you can get anywhere books are sold. Is this out as an ebook too, David?
Absolutely, it's out as an ebook, and it's out as an audiobook, and I read the audio this time, which was really interesting. I was in the studio for about 12 hours to nail it down. It was a fun process.
Was it really fun?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, you know, 12 hours is a long time, but yeah. I'm glad I did it.
Good. Well, I'm glad somebody else didn't read it, because the authenticity, the excitement's going to be there when you're there.
Yeah.
So two more concepts here I want to touch on. Agile selling. So, you know, the big data and agile are used in slightly different ways in the government market. So what is agile selling?
Well, the big data aspect that we just touched on is this idea of looking at signals and triggers, and then the agile selling comes in because you've got to be good and ready when the time is right. Now, I'll give you just a little simple story to illustrate that. I had to move my office from one floor of my building to another floor of my building, and I've got a small company. It's not very many, not much stuff, and it's not a big move. So I took a couple of photos of the office and what I have, and I sent the photos along with my requirements by email to three different moving companies that I found through a Google search for moving companies in my area. And I sent all the emails at almost exactly the same time. And the first response I got back came in within 2 hours, sort of a little bit under 2 hours, and it said, thanks for sending me along the pictures and along and your requirements. We can do the job for this number of dollars. We can do it on this particular date. Please let us know what you'd like to do. The second offer came in 6 hours later, and it was a phone call. And it was a phone call that I didn't answer because I wasn't in my office at the time. The person left a voicemail and said, this is the other moving company here, and we would love your business. Please call us back on this number. And then the third person got back to me the next morning, so about 18 hours or about 20 hours later, and they said, thank you very much for your email inquiry. We'd love to do business with you. Here's our price quote. And their price quote was actually a few hundred dollars cheaper than the one that I got the day before. And I went with, Mark, can you guess which one?
I would assume you'd go with the one that responded first.
I went with the one that responded first, not the one who asked me to call back, not the one who had the lowest price. And the reason is because I wanted someone who's going to do the work right. And I figured if they got back to me right away, they're going to arrive here on time, they're going to get the work done right. So the idea of agile selling, I mean, that's a real simple example. It's just getting back to people quickly. Another aspect of agile selling is knowing when the buyer is ready. Now, how can you know when the buyer is ready? Well, there's a number of different signals, and we talked about that in the last segment, but one other aspect of that is this concept I call newsjacking. Newsjacking is the art and science of injecting your ideas into a breaking news story. So if you know that the marketplace is interested in your products or services because of what's happening in the news, that's the perfect time for agile selling. So for example, if there's a change in a government regulation, or if there's an acquisition in your marketplace, something like that happening in the news, you can take advantage of that by, number one, maybe writing a blog post or commenting on it in some way, but then also reaching out to your buyers, reaching out to your sales prospects, and telling them your take on this breaking news story. So, hey, we just heard that this particular government agency has a regulatory change. This is what it means for us. Let us know if you want more information. Getting that kind of thing out in half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour after that regulatory change is announced, huge, huge stuff.
Well, the other part of the newsjacking is making certain the media knows about it. And you cover this actually in a book called Newsjacking.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of a marketing and public relations technique where newsjacking gets you into the media.
Exactly.
And absolutely, that's huge. But also it's a selling technique because when there's one of these things going on, something's happening in the news, you know, there's a hurricane that just went through your neighborhood, and that means that people without power, there's all sorts of ramifications. If you have a business that's related to power or cleanup or whatever it is, that is your time to be incredibly agile, and newsjacking can be an opportunity because you can then reach out. I have a buddy who's an insurance agent, and every time there's a storm is predicted for our area, I live in the Boston area, he'll send out an email and said, just make sure that, you know, your storm windows are down and that your patio furniture is in, all this sort of thing, and it gets you thinking about insurance because it's an agile selling opportunity.
Mm-hmm. It's a good reminder to CYA, and it's coming from the person that it should come from.
Exactly.
So
exactly right.
So real-time engagement is the rule number five.
What I describe as real-time engagement is the concept of flipping what is normal for most companies, which is to communicate on their time frames, and flip it around to being ready to communicate on the customer's time, on the buyer's time. Now, the difference here is that many, many companies have their selling process, their selling cycle, and it's memorialized in their CRM system, their customer relationship management system. And, you know, back in the days when we had to sell people, you know, that's how you did it. You had your process, and you had to convince people to go from one step to the next. But now people make those decisions themselves. And so smart companies need to understand that the buyers are in charge, and they need to be focused on, at the right time, communicating to buyers when they're ready. And that goes back to what we discussed earlier around things like trigger events and other things. But if a buyer is on your site and they just downloaded your white paper on a particular topic, that's a good time to reach out to them about what they've just downloaded that white paper on. Not when your CRM system tells you 2-3 days from now, but now, right this minute, right now, in real time. And that doesn't happen in a lot of companies.
Okay. So there's one recurrent theme, really, that I find in your books, and that's the message of educating and informing. So
educate and inform. You know, one of the things when I was doing my research for this book over the last couple of years that I kept hearing people talk about is how they sell, you know, and they're trying to sell something. And when I looked at the companies that were the most successful, the companies that were growing the most quickly, the companies that were engaging their marketplace, it seemed to me that those were the companies that were helping people. They were helpful. They were providing valuable information. They were essentially providing a service to people. And those were the companies that they wanted to do business with. So educating and informing is just a great way to build business. You become the trusted advisor. You become the person that people seek out. You become the person that they refer their friends and their colleagues and their family members to. And that means that you focus your attention more on being helpful and less on actually selling. It's kind of counterintuitive, but you sell more when you stop selling.
Well, there you go. David, it's always a pleasure to, number one, have you on the show, but to find a new book and then just, you know, sit down and relax and enjoy. And for both the books that we discussed, the Marketing the Moon, the New Rules of Sales and Service, there's just a lot of great, great stuff.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate that.
Different focuses, but great, great books. This is not my day job. I don't do radio for money. LinkedIn now has over 320 million members, a third of those in the U.S., nearly 3 million within 50 miles of this radio station. And if I move that out to 75 miles, we're at about 3.3 million. 1.4 million feds, uniform personnel, and DOD personnel on LinkedIn. And your LinkedIn profile is the cornerstone of your business future. And both your personal and your business profile need to work 24/7. So let me ask you this. What's in your LinkedIn profile? If you don't like the answer, give me a call. Drop me a line at markamtower@gmail.com. And thank you very much for listening to Amtower Off Center.
You've been listening to Amtower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Amtower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.